Today is the second Sunday after the Epiphany. It's also the Sunday before Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Among my preaching friends, last week's Facebook chatter was filled with references to the need to recognize Dr. King today. The chatter seemed busier than in past years and reflected events over the last couple of weeks and the last several months. Because many of my preaching friends are white mainline Protestants, there were a lot of references to King's letter from Birmingham jail. Its implications resonate especially deeply this year. The letter from Birmingham jail turned up in my sermon last year at this time. In light of the national news, it's worth revisiting. I should remind you that King wrote it in 1963, about 4 months before the March on Washington. He addressed it to 8 white Alabama clergymen, 2 of whom were Episcopal bishops. Those 8 were generally pretty progressive on integration, but they objected to the movement's tactics. Together, they had written an open letter to the press in which they disagreed with the demonstrations going on in Birmingham, advocated for more gradual change, and criticized King as an outside agitator. On Facebook, one of my former seminary colleagues referenced a particular part of the letter from Birmingham jail. I went back to the full original, and I want to read both what he posted and the part leading up to what he posted. It goes like this. So King wrote, "There was a time when the church was very powerful, and the time when the early Christians rejoiced at being deemed worthy to suffer for what they believed. In those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and principles of popular opinion. It was a thermostat that transformed the mores of society. Whenever the early Christians entered a town, the people in power became disturbed and immediately sought to convict the Christians for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. But the Christians pressed on in the conviction that they were a colony of heaven, called to obey God rather than man. Small in number, they were big in commitment. They were too God-intoxicated to be astronomically intimidated. By their effort and example, they brought an end to such ancient evils as infanticide and gladiatorial contests. Things are different now. So often the contemporary church is a weak, ineffectual voice with an uncertain sound. So often it is an arch defender of the status quo. Far from being disturbed by the presence of the church, the power structure of the average community is consoled by the church's silent, and often even vocal, sanction of things as they are. But the judgment of God is upon the church as never before. If today's church does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, it will lose its authenticity, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. Every day, I meet young people whose disappointment with the church has turned into outright disgust." Dr. King was trying to motivate those white Christian pastors, and his words remain relevant for us today. They are a call to Christians like us to act. This year, I can't help but read them in the shadow of the Capitol building. Imagine the Christian insurrectionists of January 6th. They certainly are motivated, but not in the way King imagined. White fundamentalist Christianity has power like never before, thanks to the mutually beneficial relationship it negotiated with the White House. White nationalist Christianity is willing to suffer and to disturb the peace. As various news outlets have reported, They see the current moment as a holy war. The seminary colleague who posted that quote from Dr. Pete King on Facebook, Peter Jarrett Shell, is a white male Episcopal priest who is married to a black female Episcopal priest. They have a biracial son. They live in Washington, D.C. In 2019, Peter published a book called Seeing My Skin, A Story of Wrestling with Whiteness. I read it shortly after it came out, and I highly recommend it. Last week, I looked it up on Amazon and noticed the reviews, which were overall quite positive. But there was a single one-star reviewer who probably hadn't actually read the book. Here's the first part of what he had to say. Color isn't the problem. Racism in any direction is the problem. It's 100% okay to be any color, creed, or culture, but don't tell others they're racist if they happen to be white, Christian, and a patriot. I don't feel bad or guilty for being white, but I do feel deeply offended when others try to tell me I shouldn't recognize myself. I refuse to self-denigrate for others' insecurity or feelings of oppression because modern-day oppression or white privilege is a myth. Well, it goes on, but I'm going to stop there. You get the drift. All that might seem very far away from us, but you might be surprised. Preachers aren't supposed to talk about the process or experience of preaching, but I will for a moment to say this. For many mainline pastors, preaching the last 4 years has been a challenge, to say the least. I'm relatively fortunate in that I can quote Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail, and I'm not likely to get a single complaint. That is simply not true for many of my colleagues, even my colleagues here in Connecticut. The Connecticut Episcopal clergy seem to agree about what we understand as the gospel imperative to justice, but the members of our congregations do not. For example, one of my close colleagues reported last week that two of her parishioners were at the Capitol on January 6th. Another reported about a reported conflict over the anti-racism training the diocese is now requiring of lay leaders. That requirement came out of a resolution passed by diocesan convention in October. I don't know what I would say today if I was preaching in their churches. This week, at least until Wednesday, it's going to be an effort for me to just keep breathing. I want the inauguration to be over. If you're Facebook friends with our friend Gabe Simerson, formerly of this congregation and sometime organist in the church and member of the choir, you've seen his posts from Washington, D.C. He's been going to school at American University for the last 4.5 years. He lives near the Capitol and has been posting photos of and stories about the security measures he's been watching increase over the last week. It's been sobering. With his permission, I want to share a few of his photos. Clearly having some challenge here. Hold on a second. I need to do this first, apparently. There we go. This is just a general one of some of the officers. Again, this is just where he walks every day. This one's actually pretty close to the Capitol. But I'm just trying to imagine how I would react walking in the neighborhood and seeing that. There's another one. Let me see. I'm trying to move my screen around. Well, okay. One of them has completely disappeared off my desktop.
Hold on a second. I'll just open it up this way. He titled this one on Facebook. What did he say? Another day, another army on my desktop, on my door stoop. This is taken from his front door. Then he also posted this one.
Terry, we're still on your Facebook page.
Oh, interesting. Well, let me try again. Thank you for that, Greg. All right, let me go back. So you probably didn't see any of them. I should have just shared from Facebook, clearly. I swear, we'll get here. Anyway, so this is the one from his front door. I assume you saw it. Greg, would you answer the question for me?
It looks like it's sharing the photo now.
Okay, this is the one taken closer to the Capitol. And then he shared this one.
The only one we've seen. Really,
oh,
is the,
okay. Sense. Apparently, I have to stop the share in between every photo. So let me do that. Now you got it?
Now we have a new one.
Okay. And then I'm going to share one more and get past these technical difficulties. So this is St. John's Church in Lafayette Square with a Black Lives Matter banner and a LGBTQ+ banner hanging nearby. Of course, we all know what happened in Lafayette Square last year. So I leave with that one on purpose, because that was a little bit of an antidote to the other ones that he was sharing. Right. So what we all know is that even after the inauguration, the conflict won't be over. Truth is, the election, the conflict, and all the other things going on won't be over. The election is turmoil has actually been a distraction from what should have been more important matters. Tomorrow, our newspapers are going to report that the number of people in the United States officially confirmed dead from COVID-19 will exceed 400,000. That's just the confirmed number. The real total is undoubtedly much higher than that, because not everybody that had died from it was tested for it. As we noted early on, the disparate when it first started, we noted that the disparate impact of the pandemic is one symptom of continuing racial inequities that are lodged throughout our social structures. Now, today's readings, both the Hebrew scripture and the gospel, are stories about call. From my first reading of them on Monday, that's what I plan to talk about today, call. It seemed a logical extension of a brief comment I made last week when I said that God called me to the church and God called all of you too. But all I could think about all week was those other Christians. I imagine that they would say that God also called them. Who's right? Them? Us? Everyone? No one? I puzzled over this all week. I hoped I'd come up with something profound to say to you and to myself, but I don't think I have yet. All I came up with is this. The test of our behavior as Christians must be the life of Jesus. Sometimes it really does come down to asking this question. What would Jesus do? And if you want to know what Jesus would do, all you have to do is read the Gospels. Jesus healed the sick and fed the hungry and socialized with the marginalized. Sometimes he talked trash to the folks in charge, but always in defense of his habits of healing the sick, feeding the hungry, and socializing with the marginalized. What would Jesus do today? He would keep doing what he did back then. In his humble kindness was great power. We can't forget that. In his humble kindness was great power. I expect that is our power too. We just have to keep doing it. I'm not sure we mainliners have fully grasped that. But I think we're closer now than we have ever been, in part because of the events of the past year. God is calling, and we have something particular to lend right now. God has been calling. Just like in those Gospels, God keeps calling until we hear. I hope we've heard. I think our time is here. I think our time is now.